Welcome to the Solari Report. Today's Thursday, December 11th, 2008. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted that you could join us this evening. This is our first Solari Report. I want to talk a little bit about our goals over the next year, but let's do that later in the hour. So much has happened over the last week that we'd just like to dive right into the current events. So let me note that first that any links discussed tonight we're going to put up on our blog at a commentary that will be entitled Solari Report December 11th. If for any reason we fail to post a link or a reference, just leave a comment there and we will make every effort to make sure that we do so. First, I want to cover some of this week's top stories at the blog in our first segment called Money and Markets. Then we're going to be joined by Franklin Sanders of the Money Changer for an update on the precious metals market to discuss possible scenarios for 2009 and how you can take action accordingly. Because so many of the questions that you posted are great questions, not just for me, but for Franklin as well, I'm going to move the Ask Catherine segment back to do with Franklin. And so Franklin and I will handle your questions together. And I want to thank you. We got great, great questions. Then we're going to turn briefly to our Let's Go to the Movie segment, where I'm going to be discussing the espionage thriller Bourne Identity and what a great job it does of describing the fallacy of privacy, particularly financial privacy. So money and markets. In the 1990s, a policy began in the United States called the strong dollar policy. As part of the strong dollar policy, what we saw happen, the central bank and treasury in combination suppressed the gold price, bubbled the debt in a series of actions that dramatically increased the value of the dollar. And as that happened, capital was moved out of the country and into markets around the world. Simultaneously, as that money was moved into those markets, we often saw crashes in those economies. So one economy is raised up, the dollar is raised high, and then the other currencies are what I would call dumps. So we have sort of a pump of one economy, a dump of the other, and money shifts out at the high price into a new economy at the low price. And you've often heard me describe this as a financial coup d'etat because it is part and parcel of an extraordinary centralization of wealth and the movement of assets out of central banks and sovereign governments into very centralized private hands. Now, what we've seen over the last year and a half is that the debt bubble has run its course, and the question I think all of us have is, okay, well, what's the end game? Now that the U.S. financial weakness is apparent to investors, not just throughout the United States, but globally, what's next? Well, one thing to watch in the news is the new players who are coming into the new administration. We are seeing the same people who engineered the strong dollar policy and the debt bubble in the 90s coming back in. Larry Summers, who was a former Secretary of Treasury and then the Deputy Secretary under Bob Rubin. Bob Rubin is not coming back into the administration that we know of, but is certainly having an influence from behind the scenes, was the first or second Secretary of the Treasury in the Clinton administration. So Rubin and his successor, Larry Summers, very much involved in engineering the strong dollar policy and the debt bubble, are back in positions of leadership or influential positions. We've watched, Naomi Klein is a very talented investigative reporter who's written a book called The Shock Doctrine. And this is a book I really recommend to you. It just came out in paperback. For those of you who want to take a deeper look at who's who in the new administration, and in addition, be prepared for sort of the worst-case scenario in 2009. Naomi Klein has in The Shock Doctrine, she covers what happened as the Latin American economies were dumped. She's written a lot on something called disaster capitalism. And she's been interviewed and ties this new administration back into the kind of philosophy and groups who are so adept at doing what's called the shock doctrine. Anyway, so if we look at the players, we have a shock doctrine looking kind of team. I also want to touch briefly on timing. As all of you who know me know, my framework for the economy is a political economy, not a market economy. The last time we went through a debt bubble bust, not as extraordinary as this one, but the last big one was in 1988, a great deal was done to help hold the economy together through the election and the inauguration, and then after the inauguration, the bigger problem started. And so if we could look at that cycle and look at next year after the inauguration, we're going to be coming in to March and April, which are the big tax and disclosure dates. And following that is when what I call the real housing recession starts. Typically, in an economic down cycle, you have economic activity slow down, income slows down. Lots of reports this week on unemployment slowing down, layoffs. Bank of America just announced another 30,000 in layoffs. So as the income drops, you start to see the natural housing recession. And so we've had a housing bubble bust. We had an economy led by housing and construction activity. Incomes are now falling, and we have yet to see the real housing recession, which has yet to start. But expect that by next summer, which is why I say I think the magnitude of the shakeout can't be determined until next fall. So what's happening this week in the financial markets? Big story, central banks are dropping yields worldwide, and the market is seeking safe havens. About 6 weeks, we saw Swiss bonds with approximately a one-year maturity move to almost a 0% yield. A very important story this week, we saw treasuries move towards a 0% yield. In theory, if this were to continue, we could see government and treasury-only money market funds with negative yields. That is, there's insufficient interest earnings to cover fees. In addition to lowering the yields, we're watching a significant increase in the monetary base by the Fed to fight deflation. In November, I put up on the blog a chart from the St. Louis Fed, which reported that the aggregate monetary base was growing at 785% on an annualized basis. That means it's doubling every 6 weeks. Yet deflation continues, which means that the multipliers in the economy are shrinking. The Fed can inject as much money as it wants into the large New York banks, but that doesn't translate into loans or economic activity on Main Street. It just subsidizes insiders with cash to cover their losses. The Federal Reserve, whose loan bailouts have been in the trillions, which are far greater than the Treasury bailout that we read so much about, announced it is considering issuing its own debt. And that has triggered speculation that the U.S. government may be contemplating a default on its debt. Again, see the stories on the blog. The U.S. government is not the only government under pressure. State and local governments are reporting problems, and those problems are showing up in the municipal bond funds. After an extraordinary rally by the dollar this year, in complete defiance of the deterioration of the U.S. government creditworthiness, the dollar has started to fall against the euro this week, and gold and silver are moving back up, with gold in the 800s. Movers and Shakers is my name for our segment where I invite people who are leading in this environment. I can't think of anyone I would rather have join me on the Saleri Report. Franklin and his family run the Money Changers, which is both a precious metals dealer and newsletter in West Point, Tennessee. They also run a working farm, have just finished building a new church where Franklin pastors a growing congregation, and I have to mention, have more fun than anyone I know doing what they do. Franklin, are you with us? I guess not. We lost Franklin. Anais, have you found him? Well, we've lost Anais. I was gonna defer questions until Franklin joined us, but let me jump to the questions because many of them are ones that I'm happy to address. One of the questions that we got is gold money a safe alternative? For those of you who are not familiar with gold money, goldmoney.com is a business started by James Turk, who is also runs one of the better newsletters in the gold world. And it is a service where you can invest online, you can buy gold and silver, and arrange for it to be deposited in Switzerland or England. And it functions through the internet. Is that you, Franklin? No, he's not with us. Hello?
I'm here.
Ah, there you are. I was just starting on the first questions, but let's jump back. I was just introducing you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here. Franklin, precious metals update. In 2008, gold went up, and then it went back down. Now we seem to be headed back up. What's happening?
Well, you have to realize first that when you have a bull market that is a long-term primary uptrend, that you're going to have ups and downs in the market, and that's normal. Gold made a bottom low in August of 2007, and then it sort of built a base across October and November, which is usual. You know, you'll see a low about that time of the year, November, December. And then it just started climbing and just went crazy and went over $1,000 by March 18th. And, of course, silver went with it. And then you get a correction. And the problem with this year's correction was that we had the worst financial crisis of the last 200 years.
Right.
And so, naturally, it drove gold below the 200- and 300-day moving averages, which is unusual for a bull market. It's not impossible, but it is unusual. And I think that was primarily motivated by the deleveraging of hedge funds who just, you know, they kept getting margin calls and margin calls. They sold everything. They sold stocks. They sold commodities. They sold gold. They sold everything. In addition, I have the suspicion, but I'm of a suspicious nature, that our friends in the federal government were selling silver to drive down the gold market. And that technique is something that they're well known for. So that's not just my paranoia speaking.
Well, one of the things I've found to be the most interesting about this market is we've seen in the last several months an extraordinary divergence between the price of physical coins and gold and silver and the spot price. And in fact, we now recently saw, this is up on the blog, a new service launched that tracks the price of gold as determined by eBay premiums.
Well, I think that's reasonable. And what you're actually seeing is called a backwardation. Normally in markets, anything that's scheduled for delivery out in the future, like, you know, this is December, let's say February gold or April gold, would be at a higher premium because there's the cost of insurance and storage and interest on the money tied up. And what you're actually seeing is a backwardation. Now, there are two reasons for that. One is the huge demand for gold in my hands now. I don't care what's happening. People want gold in their hands now because there's too much financial chaos and turmoil, and they want something safe in their hands now. The other reason is that, you know, the physical gold and silver markets are very, very small compared to, say, the market for bonds or currencies. And the supply chain is very, very thin. And basically what happened was a buying panic between August and today, and that has emptied out that chain so that the premiums on gold coins have roughly tripled and the premiums on silver have gone up about 10 times over what they were.
Well, it's amazing. You and I talked yesterday, and I've never heard you. You're not someone who says that anything is urgent. I would say that having lived with this kind of, you know, sort of understanding what's really going on in the world, you've learned to be calm about the whole thing. And yesterday you said to me that if somebody is going to buy coins, they should do it now. And that's the first time I've ever heard you say that.
Oh, there's no question about that. I've been in business 28 years, and I've never seen a time when I could not pick up the phone if I wanted to order $1 million worth of gold or silver and not have it delivered within a week. And now people just say, well, I'll get it when I can get it.
Right. You know?
And that's in some cases on coins because, of course, the national mints that mint these coins, being typical government enterprises, don't respond to demand. They just stop minting coins.
Right.
U.S. government, for instance, has stopped minting silver eagles and the fractional gold coins, and they have no announced date when they will resume minting.
One of the things you and I talk a lot about what's going to happen next, mm-hmm. and, of course, being at the end of the year and doing planning for 2009, I'm thinking a lot about, okay, what's going to happen? What are the scenarios? And we're watching the Federal Reserve fight very significant deflation in the economy. But we also know that when you print this much money with bailouts and with sort of lending with funny collateral, that we could turn around and have hyperinflation. And I would love you to just touch on what are some of the signs of deflation versus hyperinflation, and what can we do to protect ourselves from either one of them?
Well, in the first place, you have to get your definitions correct. Most people think of inflation means rising prices. That's like saying that wet streets cause rain. it doesn't work that way. The inflation causes the rise in prices, and there's usually a lag of, 12, maybe 18 months to 2 years before it really shows up in prices. However, they have slammed $8 trillion worth of credit into the system. $8 trillion. I mean, think about the magnitude of that number. That's more than half of the United States national income.
Right.
The GDP. And there is no way that they're going to be able to control the inflation out of that. I mean, they're going to try, but at the very least, there will be a massive, massive rise in prices. And if they're not good, if they're not really clever, it's going to be a massive hyperinflation. And hyperinflation, of course, is defined as an increase in prices of more than 2% of more than 10% a month. Well, think what that means. That means that the gallon of gas you bought on the 1st of January for for $4 is going to cost $11.85 on December the 31st.
Right.
And that's what countries around the world have seen. We have been told, oh, that'll never happen here. We have the Fed in charge and that won't happen. Well, I don't know how they're going to be able to contain this. You have to remember, too, that the Fed's job is not to control inflation. The Fed was created as an engine of inflation.
Right.
Their job is to manage inflation. Expectations. You see? That's a different thing. And so they trot out all of these experts, and they talk about the dangers of deflation and so forth. And there is a reason for that, but I'll come to that in a minute. They know what they've done. They know what the cost of what they've done will be in terms of depreciating the dollar. And so you get these people talking about deflation. They're looking at the Great Depression of the 1930s. And the whole structure, the whole institutional structure of finance is different today than it was in the 1930s. You have to understand that the establishment, the Fed, was caught in a deflation that they could not stop. But today, the whole banking system is different. There's no goal backing for anything. There's no objective
right.
backing. All of that's been removed, and they built in addition, a huge number of automatic circuit breakers that kick in whenever deflation threatens. And so, consequently, we live in a completely different world. We're not going to have a deflationary outcome out of this. Now, you do have a deflation in debt in the sense that debt is imploding, that you have an increasing number of bankruptcies, that people who thought they were well off find that their assets suddenly have depreciated in value, like the stock market, from 12,000 down to 8,500. That's a huge loss,
right?
A huge deflation. and there's a lot of debt that's going bad, which is pretty much predictable because they pumped up this enormous debt bubble. So that all of that will, you know, you're going to have actually a deflationary, an inflationary depression.
Right.
So you'll have inflationary monetary conditions while you have deflationary economic conditions. It's the worst of all possible worlds.
Right. So if you have incomes falling, my income's going down, at the same time my expenses are going up, at the same time the investments that my savings are invested in, if unless I'm careful, are also going down. So I'm getting hit by a triple whammy.
Right. That's exactly right.
Right. And what I call the slow burn is where that happens steadily and slowly, but you have things like bailouts that constantly protect the insiders. So the outsiders are not protected, but the insiders are.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, when I was at the big investment conference in New Orleans last month, Franklin,
mm-hmm.
and one of the scenarios promoted by several of the newsletter writers there was the concept of an overnight devaluation. Rather than letting inflation take hold, the way to deal with the debt would be to have a significant devaluation. And I'm assuming this would be something that G8 would have to do. You'd have to see it not just on the dollar, but on the euro and the other big fiat currencies, that you would see an overnight revaluation allowing precious metals to rise to its market price of, say, $2,000 to $3,000, and devalue all the currencies, thus dramatically reducing the cost of dealing with the debt.
Well, I think that's true. You know, one of the things that they have to do is to devalue the dollar so that the burden of the debt becomes less than what it was before. And so they're caught in a kind of trap of their own making. They more or less have to devalue the dollar. They think they have to increase the money supply so that the economy will get up off its back. The fact is that the inflation will only make it worse.
Right.
Everything they do will only make it worse. And the proof of that is seen in the 1930s. When Roosevelt came in, he seized all the gold. He upvalued the gold from $20.67 an ounce to $35 an ounce. People don't know about it, but he did the same kind of thing in silver. And the result was terrible. In 1937, late 1937, 38, there was a worse crash in the stock market than had occurred in 1929. And the only thing that got the country out of the depression was a war.
Right. And that, I think that's one of the reasons you see such a commitment in many quarters to a war economy, because they know that that has historically worked for them.
Right. And they're going to do it again.
Now, we also, another couple stories and posts on my blog refer to the possibility of a default on the U.S. debt. And I think one of the questions for 2009 is, do we think such a default is possible?
Well, you know, Catherine, I'm always very suspicious of any obligation that the U.S. government offers. I have to say that because I understand that, you know, if you talk to an economist, he says, well, the safest thing in the U.S. economy, the lowest interest security is U.S. government debt, and therefore you don't have to worry about that. Well, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous because the U.S. government has a long-held record of defaulting on its debt. One way or the other, it defaults on its debt. Now, you can look at the revolutionary period and the Continentals. You can look at the period of the war between the states. You can look at the Great Depression, and you can see that the government always defaults on its debt when it gets into a crunch. So I think that's one of the things you have to think about, and it's not refuge to flee into bonds. you're going into a trap if you flee into government debt. And so the best thing you can do, because you know they're going to depreciate the dollar, they've already put the inflation there, we just haven't seen the price rises yet, that you have to stay away from dollars and from U.S. government debt. And you have to find some refuge. And, of course, the greatest refuge is, the most obvious, is gold and silver. But there is another one, too, that people really ought to think about, and that is income-producing assets. Assets that produce a stream of revenue that is safe even when the economy is in trouble.
Or I would say it another way. I would say not only income-producing assets, but expense-reducing assets.
Well, that too. Yeah.
One of the questions we got was under buying real assets,
mm-hmm.
In lieu of attempting to accumulate physical cash and holding places at home, what type of real assets would you consider to be good investments to have or hold or even utilize?
I don't want to sound silly, but seeds.
Uh-huh, seeds.
anything that makes you more independent of the national economy is a good investment. I know that my wife and I, the very best garden and the most productive we ever had was grown on a city lot in Memphis. We had about a 100 by 150 foot lot, and we planted a garden in our flower beds, and we literally ate off of that garden for a whole year.
Right.
It was just crazy. I mean, what kind of investment can you find that has a return like that?
Right. Right. And it's interesting. I tell everyone the best after-tax yield you can get this year, other than short funds, is on stockpiling non-perishables.
Right.
So everything you use in your home. About 3 months ago, I forget what happened. There was some dire news that came probably through the email, and I thought, oh, Lordy, this thing is really about to explode. And I thought, maybe I should go into town and get some more cash, make sure I have plenty of cash. And then I thought, no, instead of doing that, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to order a 2-year supply of the best multivitamins I know.
Well, what you're pointing to is the same thing that during the German hyperinflation of 1920 to 23 drove workers to race. They would be paid twice a day, literally, and they would race to the gates of the factory with their money and hand it to their wives, and the wives would go out and buy anything they could buy, because
right.
anything you bought today was going to be cheaper than what you bought tomorrow.
Right, and it's not just a matter of price. I think if you have plenty of provision for whatever you need to do your work and to live comfortably, then as we see these dire predictions or dire news, then you don't run the risk of being hiccuped. Because to me the danger is if suddenly you wake up and you need paper to do your business and you don't have it. So you're simply running the risks of being inconvenienced and having to worry. The one of the things I've realized, because you often say what we need to do is change our thinking on these things,
mm-hmm.
And that's the first big change that has to happen. Our generation, Franklin, has been trained to think of, we put our money into stocks and bonds or other kinds of investments, and we earn a yield, and then we use that yield to go out into the marketplace and buy products and services. And that's a model where we've been intermediated. So we're depending on large, distant organizations for both our financial yield and then our provision of goods and services. And, of course, where we're moving back to is a model that says, okay, how can I disintermediate and instead depend on myself or those around me or those in my network who I have an intimate relationship for the provision. So, for example, I had one friend who kept complaining about her water bill and the quality of her water. At the same time, she was worried that her yields were dropping on her investments. And, Lord, that was before they started dropping towards zero. And I said, well, this is really simple. Why don't you just sell your investments and build a well?
Right, exactly.
And she said, why don't, you know, but there was a big mental barrier in thinking that way. And I think it's a big shift for many of us to move into that new model.
Well, because we're all locked into this national economy idea. We're all locked into someone else is going to provide these services, and so we don't have to independently provide them for ourselves. And, you know, the word disintermediation is a very important one, because what you've wrapped up there is this concept that I can't let other people do things. I can't expect other people to do things for me that I really am going to have to do for myself. Water is the example that you gave.
Right.
But what this points to is a solution in developing local economies.
Right.
Local economies being people I can trust, people I can depend on, people who, you know, it may be your farmer down the road who is going to plant vegetables or who has animals that you can eat. And you know this person, you know you can trust him, you know he does a good job. And so you develop a relationship with him so that you're sort of part of his family. I mean, when we think about community, we have to think about it as a family. You do one thing, I do another thing. We work together. We work together to support each other. And
we find a way to have fun doing it.
Exactly.
when people who live in the cities who really don't know their neighbors say to me, oh, my God, this is overwhelming. Where do I start? The first thing I say is, go find the food people.
Right.
Go find the Weston Price group, or go find the group that's organized around the farmer's market. One, food is so important, and two, it's not just a matter of price, it's a matter of quality. You know, you really need to establish that the food you're buying is coming from somebody you can trust. And but there's such positive people who organize. So when somebody says to me, what's the real asset I should first care about, I say, go find the food people.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that I found about the food people, whether they're the Weston Price people or the local food people, and there are a lot of different groups, food co-ops, for instance. Excuse me. Sorry. They are always positive people.
Yeah.
They're upbeat. They know where they're going, and they're not downcast about how they're going to get there. And that's what, you know, morale is a big element,
right,
of surviving. It's a big element that, you know, to be with people who are determined, we're going to do this thing anyway, and it doesn't matter what kind of roadblock pops up in our way, we're going to get around it.
One of my favorite moments over at the Money Changer at your farm, I was sitting in what I call the trading floor, where you all sit around and deal precious metals. And it was a particularly stressful day in the market. I forget what was happening to the price, but it was moving wildly. And your son, Justin, stood up, put down his phone, and he said, he had his big rubber boots, and he says, I'm going out to feed the hogs. I said, now there's perspective. So it's, precious metals and food is a nice balance. Well, let me give you some of the questions, because we got a lot of great questions. And I know this is one there's nobody better at handling this. Is it still prudent to buy gold and silver coins? Do you feel numismatic coins are a good investment in these conditions?
Numismatic coins are absolutely not a good investment under these conditions. And the reason is because there is a widespread revaluation of all values. And that revaluation will take all values down to their real value. It's not just debt that society and people are looking at and saying, oh, I don't think this fellow's debt is any good. I think his word, he may want to make good on his debt, but he won't be able to. It's not just that. They're going to look at the value of every asset and say, okay, what's the bottom line here? What's the minimum value for this thing? And numismatic coins require a rising personal income to keep their prices rising. It's really the worst possible way that you can invest in precious metals. What you want to do is to get as close as you can possibly get in what you buy to the actual metal value of the item.
So as little premium over melt value as possible.
Absolutely, yeah. And even in these roiled markets where the premium of so many things has risen, still you've got to look to buy the cheapest thing that you can get.
Now, what the numismatic dealers will say is the numismatic coins can't be confiscated.
Well, I know they say that. And, you know, if you go to my website, you'll find a number of articles that delve into the legal realities of the situation. And the fact is that there's nothing that exempts those coins from being confiscated. But the whole idea of confiscation really is based on a banking structure and a financial structure that no longer exists.
Well,
Roosevelt,
the last time it happened, the percent of American savings that was in gold and silver was very high. Today it's very low. So as you always say, if you're going to confiscate something, you got to go where the money is, and it's not there.
No, I hate to say it. I know it's going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. It's in 401ks and IRAs.
Right.
And what they're liable to do is to say, okay, all these 401ks and IRAs, you're going to have to invest now in government debt. And you don't have any choice, and we're going to take over all these accounts, and the Social Security Administration is going to administer them. And that's not as crazy as it sounds.
Well, as a practical matter, we've seen more and more restrictions on what 401ks and IRAs. If you look at what a European can invest in,
mm-hmm.
versus what you can do here in a 401k and IRA, the restrictions are greater and greater. And I should also note, GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, sent a letter to Treasury saying, you know, is it possible that you could confiscate gold? Do you reserve the right to confiscate gold? And they wrote back and said, we reserve the right to confiscate everything.
Right. That's exactly right. But again, you have this refuge. They're going to go where the money is. It's just
right.
Like Willie, what's his name, the bank robber back in the 30s. Somebody asked him, why do you rob banks? And his quick response was, because that's where the money is. Silly.
The next question, is gold money a safe alternative? Is James Turk's gold money still a reasonable alternative to COMEX trading, and can it be considered a physical holding? Would you see any dangers with this account in a total market collapse?
I do not recommend any storage schemes except gold money, and the reason is because I have, over the course of the last nearly 30 years in the market, seen so many storage schemes collapse. The difference with gold money is, first of all, I know James Turk, and I've known him since 1985, and I understand the man's integrity. Secondly, and this is always a good check on integrity, he has bookkeeping on his side. He actually has an outside third-party auditor who audits the presence of the gold to make sure that it's there. He publishes the bar numbers on the bars. He's not hiding anything. He's got complete transparency. So I think in that sense, it is a good alternative. If, assuming that the United States does not put on exchange controls and things that make it difficult to move your money back and forth, gold money would be an indispensable resource for people who need to keep cash in some form that they could readily access it. In other words, If you get to a hyperinflation, you don't want to be holding cash. You want all of your money to be out of dollars, all of your capital be out of dollars as much as possible. So gold money offers you a way to keep that money in gold when you need it, access it, get 24-hour availability of the funds, and uh, that's there's just not any other place you could get that kind of service.
I was talking once to a consultant who I wanted to hire to do a project for me, and he had a gold money account, and so he finally, at the end of the conversation, we'd agreed on a price. He said, "When will I be paid?" I said, "You've already been paid. Check your gold money holdings." And, it, you know, it was magical.
So, oh, it is.
Yeah. So yeah. So I think as more and more people have accounts, you know, it's a very simple way to transact globally.
Oh, gosh.
I found to be very and, of course, you know, I don't want everything next to me. I like having something. I like having something in Switzerland.
Well, you know, even a rabbit has two ways out of his hole. And if you've got, you know, if you've got some money out of the country, they can't steal what they can't reach. They can't steal what they can't find. And my experience and my philosophy has always been, the best way to stay out of trouble is to not be where it is.
Right.
And so if you can get the money out of their reach now, then there's a lot to be said from that.
Next question, Franklin. How to test gold or silver coins bought online for fakes? How does one detect a counterfeit coin purchased online? If a reliable test is available, what recourse does one have? How can you prove a fake coin was received from a particular vendor and not already in your possession?
Well, most dealers are extremely sensitive to this kind of problem. So if you call them and say, "Hey, I got this coin from you and it's phony," they will respond. But there, with gold coins, there's really there are two very easy ways to check. The first is you take one of the coins and you balance it on the middle finger of your left hand. That is, you just lay it flat on that middle finger, and then you take a coin in the other hand and you just tap the edge of that coin, and you will hear a very harmonious ring that lasts a long time out of the coin. Now, if you're going to get the weight in the coin correct, you'll have to, if it's a counterfeit, you'll have to make it out of lead. And lead does not ring that way.
Mm-hmm.
Also, then you check the weight, and the weights of these coins are very, very exact. Now, the place that test will not work is with 24-karat gold coins like Maple Leafs or Philharmonics, because 24-karat coins do not ring that way. But all of the alloyed coins, the 90% coins or the 22-karat coins, will all ring that way. It's very easy to tell, you know, whether they really are what they're supposed to be. So that's the quick and dirty way to do it. And if a coin rings, the next thing to check is the weight, because a brass coin, which will be what kind of counterfeit rings, will not be anywhere near the right weight. So, and then one other check is just familiarity. You know, after you see the coins, you know what they're supposed to look like. Counterfeit coins never look quite right. There's some problem. The color's wrong. The detail on the coin is not right. The dental work around the side or the milling around the edges will not be right.
Okay, last question. Dollar collapse, will debt be wiped out? If collapse, your preparation recommendations. Also, I've heard it said that our credit card debt would be devalued with the dollar, so it's not a great time to pay down debt if you have cash. If the dollar spirals down to zero, then your debt would be wiped out. True or false?
Well, possibly true. yes and no is the answer to that. In 1948 in Germany, after World War II, when the German economy was trying to get back up in the air, there was a revaluation, but the mark was revalued, let's say, down 10 to 1. So if you had a bank account with 100 marks in it, you found suddenly it had 10 marks in it. But the debt was not revalued at quite the same scale. So depending on what the debt was, you might have come out ahead and you might have come out behind. Classically, in an inflation, you want to be in debt. Now, that's a thing that's very, very difficult for me to get out of my mouth, because debt is a terrible dastardly burden on your life, and you want to stay out of debt as much as you can. But right now, if I had a mortgage on a house, I would not be working to pay off that mortgage. I would be, you know, I'd just be making minimum payments. But I think it's a very, very dangerous thing to think that your debt, to rack up debt, thinking, oh yeah, my debt will be wiped out when they revalue the currency. That might and might not be true. You might find yourself owing more than you owed before.
Well, what I feel is it's very dangerous to try and game the system.
Oh, heavens yes.
Because we're up against house rules.
Yeah.
And so the issue is, if you have a dollar, a free dollar available, the question is, how can you use that dollar to best reduce your risk? And so there are many different things that reduce your risk, being more self-sufficient and having, you know, investing in income-earning assets. All these different things we've talked about reduce your risk, you know, withdrawing from doing business with institutions that behave in the ways that some of these institutions do, all reduce the risk. So the question is, where can you put that incremental dollar to reduce your risk? And I think debt has a tremendous amount of risk in this environment, because having no debt gives you tremendous flexibility.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, one of the things too, I think that you have to think about is there's some sort of non-monetary investments that you can make. And the greatest of those, and the most difficult, frankly, is, how do I invest in my local economy? How do I become a partaker in my local economy? And not just a partaker, but a partaker who has the respect of the other participants in the local economy. In other words, how do I become their friend? How do I become someone they want to play ball with? And that's not going to be easy. One of the suggestions you made earlier about finding the clean food people, that's a good place to start. Find the people who have a food co-op. Find the people who are, you know, what we would call maniacs, lunatics about clean food, about fresh food, and, you know, make friends with those people, because they're the ones that are going to keep functioning. And you have to keep in mind, there is a possibility. Now, I'm not predicting this. I'm just saying there's a possibility that it will be very, very difficult to function unless you have connections in the local economy.
About 2-3 years ago, one of the local farmers and I sat down and we made a list of all the skills. I guess it was right after Katrina. Mm-hmm. All the skills that we would need to survive in a worst case scenario, and then we put together a dinner group. We meet once a month for dinner, and with people who've got all sorts of different kinds of skills, and we talk about things that we can do to really help each other reduce our expenses or improve the quality of our lives. And for the first year, it was just very uncomfortable. You know, we're getting to know each other. It was, you know, sometimes the food was good, sometimes it wasn't, and it took about a year. And then all of a sudden, you know, a lot of the discussions were painful, because there were all these things I knew I should do, but I didn't know how to do, and I didn't want to do, and, you know, but the next thing you know, I got the orchard going and the garden going, and then it got to be fun.
Right.
You know, it got to be fun. And so now everybody's coming over Saturday for a pecan shaking. We're going to shake all the pecan trees. Well, apparently, you know, pecans are something, their price has skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
So now everybody in the neighborhood is fighting for pecans. Well, Franklin, thank you very much.
You're
going to be back with us on January 15th and February 12th, because I think we're going to need a lot of precious metals updates during 2009.
Right. Well, let me throw in one more comment.
Please, and also describe your website and how people can access.
Okay. Well, they can get to my website if they go to www.silverismoney.com. That will take you to the Money Changer website, and that's the simplest address to remember. But one of the things that I'd like for your listeners to understand is, we have come through the worst. We have come through the deleveraging of the hedge funds, all the things that would drive gold and silver down. We've made a low in mid-November, and now we're we're completing a bottoming process that will end in a rally that will take gold and silver much, much higher into the spring. So I can say right now with a huge degree of confidence, go buy gold and silver. Don't mess around. 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, I might have said, well, let's wait and see what's going to happen. We may not be at the bottom yet and so forth. Now I have great confidence in saying this is the time. Now is the time you better act, because when you act later, if you try to wait and think you might find a better price, you may find yourself paying a lot worse price, a lot higher price. So I would go on and act now. And it's the height of foolishness. Most of America, it seems to me, is just sort of standing there waiting. They're just sort of looking as if, oh well, nothing very different will happen. Something very different has happened, Catherine.
Right.
The Federal Reserve and Wall Street have completed a coup d'etat of the government. They have taken over the government. They have hijacked it.
Right.
And what will happen in the next 4 years, Obama notwithstanding, is not going to be pretty. And you're going to have to protect yourself, because they're not going to protect you.
Right, I agree. I was at a wonderful coffee clutch in my neighborhood the other day, and somebody came up to me and said, "What do you think is going on?" And I said, "I think we're on our own."
Precisely.
Okay, Franklin, thank you so much. We look forward to having you back on January 15th.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so let's go to the movies. The goal of this segment is, for many years I found the best vehicle that I can use to describe to people what's going on in a way that helps inform them about what they can do about it is the movie. So I've come down to sort of this last segment of the Solari Report, where I can use the movies to describe a little bit about what's going on and what we can do about it. One of my favorite action movies is the three Bourne series, and I just want to touch on the Bourne Identity, which is the first. For those of you who haven't seen the Bourne Identity, it's the story of a CIA assassin who develops amnesia on an assignment that goes wrong and then tries to discover the truth about himself and ultimately take himself out of the business of being an assassin. At one point in the movie, early on, he's trying to evade the CIA, and he bumps into a girl at the American Embassy who's applying for a visa and ends up getting into a car with her to get away from his pursuers, and in very short order, the CIA is able to profile her and has an amazing amount of information. If you read the script, one person at the CIA turns and says, "Who is she?" And the other person turns and says, "She's 26, born outside of Munich. Father was a welder. He died in 91. We don't have the mother. There may be a stepsister. We're trying to track that down. It's tough. She's a wanderer. She pops up on the grid here and there. But, I mean, the last time she paid an electric bill in Europe was 94. No taxes, no steady employers. She's got three arrests, two shoplifting cases, one in Spain, one in Germany, and she actually did 3 months in an Italian detention center for credit card fraud." Now, what's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is there are no secrets. As we go through our day-to-day life, remember that many of your actions and transactions leave behind a data trail, and the speed at which that data can be collected and aggregated and integrated and matched with other data is quite remarkable. And adapting to this kind of transparency is a subject we're going to come back to regularly on the Solari Report. Next week's movie is Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard me refer to it either in my speeches or writing. I used to call it my training film. If you get a chance, watch it ahead of our discussion and send any questions you have about it. If there are movies you'd like me to watch and consider for the Solari Report, I hope you will post them with your questions at the subscriber panels. If for any reason you have difficulty accessing your panel, you can also post them on my blog. Now, the Solari Report, let me just say a few things about what I hope to accomplish with the Solari Report. I want a way of... We're going to have three conference calls a a month. And I want a way of looking at what I call the real deal, which is what's really going on, looking under the carpet, looking at the dark side, but doing it in a way that maintains a really positive attitude. I'm not comfortable with news that glosses over the darker side of life. At the same time, I'm not interested in dwelling on the darker side because my focus is on taking action. What are the actions that we can take in our lives, in our homes, in our businesses, in our communities, which protect us and which start to really shift our situation? Of course, what I come back to again and again and again is how can we withdraw from people and institutions who are not acting in the highest and best interest of either us or the greater good, and instead shift to support those who are. And my interest is money. Our interest on the Solari Report is money. At the same time, we want to look at life on an integrated basis. So money is a navigation tool to help us understand what's going on. I always tell the story when I worked in Washington as Assistant Secretary of Housing during the Bush administration, I would be dealing every day with the budgets and the financial allocations and the real money, and I would, you know, when you're dealing with the budgets, you know what's really going on because it's, you know, the money's going this way and that, and you can see what's really happening. But every day I'd wake up and I'd read the paper, and the paper would describe what was going on, which had nothing to do with what was really going on in the money. It was sort of a multiple personality disorder. And so I like to talk about money because I think money is a great navigation tool, and it's just like the movie said, follow the money, Deep Throat. So money is a navigation tool, and money is also a tool that we use to build our world. So I want to look at our assets and our investments, but also all those things that are critical to building our world, our health, our food, our community. One of my bugaboos, for those who know me, is I really feel that we don't invest enough in good health, good food, in community, in family, because in difficult times, those are the things that really see us through. I want to also mention that that nothing that I say on any of these calls should be taken as investment advice, because investment advice requires an understanding of each person and each unique situation, which, of course, we don't have. Now, looking ahead over the next 2 weeks, next week we have December. We're going to be doing the Solari Report again on Thursday night, December 18th. Movers and Shakers is going to be with John Rappaport. John is an investigative reporter. When anybody says to me, comes to me and said, look, I really want to understand the world. I really want to understand what's going on. I want to take off the veil. One of the first things I do is I say, read everything John Rappaport ever wrote, and then call me back. John's just an incredible resource. A lot of his work now is focused on how we can use our imagination and our creativity in this kind of environment to completely shift our lives and what's happening in very positive ways. Again, the movie we're going to be talking about is Enemy of the State, so if you have a chance before joining us, please feel free to watch or rewatch Enemy of the State. December 26th, day after Christmas, we're going to be doing the year-end wrap-up. No movers and shakers joining us. We're not going to talk about movies. It's just my assessment of what's happened over the whole year 2008 and what things look like for 2009. So don't forget to send your questions, log on to the subscriber control panel, give questions, give feedbacks, anything you want me to address in your end wrap-up. I'm delighted to see your suggestions. So thank you very much for being a subscriber to the Solari Report. The whole Solari team is really excited about this. You're in our prayers. We look forward to being with you next week and three times a month. Until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.